You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2018 and the November 2018 issues of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Dead End on Highway 1 by Adam Leith Gallner. Photos by William Hereford. While walking home on Highway 1 after an altercation with Estes, Hughes was run over, backed over, then run over again. This occurred next to an intersection that has long been touted as the mythical crossroads where the blues legend Robert Johnson promised his soul to the devil in exchange for his otherworldly mastery of the guitar. The same is also said of another junction just up Highway 1 in Clarksdale. Today, the County Sheriff's Department has no record of the Hughes or Warren incidents. Ronnie Estes did not respond to multiple requests for comment. In 1996, Estes pleaded guilty to two counts of aggravated assault after shooting a woman named Jean Washburn in the face and her husband Richard in the knee. Estes received 5 years, yet the judge suspended 4 years of his sentence on the condition he not commit any other offenses or own a gun during a probationary period. But he was charged again with aggravated assault for shooting yet another man, William Michael Fortenberry, in the thigh. Estes, who claimed that the gun went off accidentally, was convicted of felonious possession of a firearm. He violated his probation in multiple other ways, all of which were chronicled in county ledgers, as was a court-ordered psychological evaluation which noted Estes' underlying antisocial psychopathology. In the 1980s and 90s, the Estes brothers were known throughout the county. Some saw them as real-life versions of the characters on Hee Haw, backwater jokesters and troublemakers. Country, real country, is how one local journalist describes them. They were legendary. Ronnie was scary dangerous, explains Gibson. He had a shield of protection over him. He could do anything. Nothing would happen. He shot someone in the head in the broad, open daylight in front of the courthouse. Estes was occasionally incarcerated for short periods, according to court records and law enforcement sources, but until the sexual battery case, he would always be released. A reporter named David Lush covered the Horsley case for the Bolivar commercial. The paper, however, never ran an article on his investigation, even though Lush says he had spoken to an elderly resident who claimed to have witnessed key details relating to the murder. "I went to talk to the source," Lush says. "He shared some things with me." But when Lush returned to follow up 2 weeks later, the man was gone. Neighbors said he'd moved across the country in a big hurry. "I'm just hoping nothing untoward happened to him, because he was seen talking to the media. He knew things." Part of the reason crimes in the Delta go unpunished is a phenomenon Lush calls the Magnolia Curtain, an old expression. Lush says he started using the phrase after seeing some remarkable magnolia trees in a cemetery north of Rosedale. "Those magnolias sweep all the way down to the ground, like they are trying to cover everything," says Lush. "There are people that know about some of the unsolved murders, but they aren't going to talk about it to this day." The only online article that mentions Patrice Horsley is a 2005 piece in the Clarksdale Press Register by Larry Liddell, headlined, "Decades Later, The Search for Truth Goes On." The story, in a tone of unmasked astonishment, notes the local sheriff's claim that in 2001, a tornado had struck the courthouse, and as a result, investigative reports related to the unsolved Rosedale murders had been blown out of the building. An aging newspaperman, Liddell steadies himself with a cane when we meet in front of the press register office in Clarksdale, the seat of Coahoma County, which, after Louisiana's Orleans Parish, has the highest murder rate in America. When I bring up the Horsley case, Liddell laughs ruefully. "I'm chuckling," he clarifies, "because there are, to my count, 11 so-called unsolved murders in Rosedale over the last 40 years. Liddell assures me that any reporters investigating serious crime in the Delta put themselves at risk. People don't want to talk to journalists, and they especially do not want to lend their name. We are closed to the world, and we choose to be that way. Next photos, guilty as charged. The Rosedale courtroom where Ronnie Estes pleaded guilty to sexual battery in 2003, and Estes in custody in 2015. I ask him what might possibly explain why so many homicide cases have gone cold here. Somebody did not do a thorough job of investigating, he surmises. Was Billy Joe Estes the chief's investigator at the time that Patrice died? For close to 30 years, Billy Joe Estes, the eldest of the Estes brothers, served as the chief deputy and top investigator for the county sheriff's department. Billy Joe was known for patrolling Rosedale with an M16 and at times a big club. He was a feared man, but also a revered paternal figure, and almost everyone interviewed for this story characterized him as a solid, competent policeman, except when it came to dealing with his youngest brother. Billy Joe was first hired as an assistant marshal on the Rosedale Police Force in 1963, at a time when Mississippi remained segregated and interracial marriage was outlawed. According to a former member of the sheriff's department, Billy Joe had a blind spot when dealing with his brother Ronnie's behavior. Billy Joe did what he wanted. Cases that Billy Joe didn't want prosecuted, they didn't get prosecuted. Gibson finally managed to change that when he helped get Ronnie Estes convicted, as Gibson puts it, for 15 years for molesting a 6-year-old. He had her performing oral sex on him. Ronnie had been living with the girl's mother, but after an alleged episode of domestic violence in 2003, she contacted the police and decided to move out. At that point, according to Gibson, the girl informed her mother of repeated instances of sex abuse. The child said that every time she tried to brush her teeth, the taste would not come off her tongue, Gibson remembers. He got in touch with Ronnie's brother Dinky, who at the time ran a furniture store and a nightclub. Gibson asked him to collect the mother's and daughter's belongings from Ronnie's house. I told Dinky we needed everything, clothes, personal hygiene stuff. The key element I was looking for was the child's toothbrush, to see if Ronnie's DNA was in there. Dinky obliged and brought the personal effects to Gibson, having conveniently placed the toothbrush in a Ziploc bag. After a forensic lab found traces of semen on the brush, Gibson secured a court order to obtain Ronnie Estes' DNA. The sample came back a match. The trial ended the morning it began when Estes' lawyers unexpectedly entered a guilty plea. The court decided not to take Ronnie's previous felonies into account. "The sentence won't be the end of your life," the judge informed Estes while reading the verdict. "You'll still have another 20, 30, 40 years to follow your release." So go there with an open mind of coming out and becoming a good citizen again, and everything will be okay. Ronnie Estes was consigned to a medium security prison an hour and a half south of Rosedale down Highway 1. When I returned to Mississippi in December 2017, Gibson asked me to meet him at a library in the town of Cleveland, a short drive from Rosedale. Upon entering the municipal library, we asked the woman at the front desk for a private place to talk. She looks at us warily, then suggests we sit in the boardroom down the hall. As we chat, Gibson proposes people I might interview. One is the mother of the child Ronnie assaulted. Gibson texts her to see if she's willing to meet. She declines, then texts back, "You know Ronnie gets out in October." Suddenly, we hear someone sneeze right outside a side door to the boardroom. We hear hushed shuffling sounds, too. "Folks listening," Gibson speculates. Undeterred, we place a phone call to Patrice Horsley's brother. Currently living in Georgia, Derek Horsley is a retired Army sergeant. "Our mother wanted the truth," he says on speakerphone. "She died with a heavy heart, not knowing what happened to her daughter. I want the issue resolved not only for me, but for my other siblings, and for my mother, and for Patrice's son as well. She had a little boy who was 2 or 3 years old when it happened." Horsley recalls that Patrice's friends liked to hang out and build bonfires next to the cemetery where she was murdered. "Everybody knows that Ronnie Estes hung around with my sister," he says, adding that their circle included some substandard druggie types. "He wants them questioned," he says, "so we can rest in peace ourselves." At that moment, Gibson looks out the window with alarm. "There's the former district attorney, Billy Joe's best friend," he says. "Let's go." We hurriedly gather our belongings, and when we walk out of the room, the ex-DA, Lawrence Mellon, is in the corridor, right outside the door. Was he summoned here, or is it merely a coincidence? Gibson, clearly uncomfortable, greets Mellon with a forced smile. The next day, Gibson escorts me around Rosedale. A sign welcomes visitors to the Delta City of Brotherly Love. We turn onto a small lane toward Patrice Horsley's murder site. Fields of cotton and beans lead to a wooded enclosure. "This is where Patrice's body was found," Gibson says. In front of us, beyond a fence, is a cemetery. In between the tombstones stand a number of immense magnolias. "It's still a party spot," Gibson comments, pointing at the beer cans strewn among the discarded condoms and bullet casings. A dead pecan tree, just inside the graveyard, appears to have been hit by lightning. The pecan juts up 12 feet into the air, shorn of its limbs, with jagged new shoots growing from the top of its ruptured trunk. As we walk, a black pickup truck with tinted windows turns into the cemetery lane. It stops 30 feet from us. After idling a few long moments, the pickup reverses slowly and drives away. Gibson unlocks his car and takes out a shotgun. "Are we in danger?" I ask. "It's a possibility." Seeing it is time to leave, we agree to resume tomorrow. The following day, Gibson is beside himself, having spent much of the morning talking to agents from the FBI. A member of his family, he says, had been shot at the previous night and escaped injury. Two white men had approached Gibson's relative and said they had a message for Gibson. Let the dead stay dead. He won't tell me which of his loved ones had been targeted. A family member. I want to leave it just like that. My life could be threatened, too. He suggests I leave town. Gibson's anxious tone brings to mind a story he told me early on. It concerned an altercation that occurred in 2003, just weeks before Ronnie Estes was convicted. One Saturday night, Gibson received a call to go to Rosedale's Club Millennium, a night spot owned by Dinky and another brother, Richard Lee Estes, who died in 2013. At that time, there had been a surge in violent incidents involving underage clubgoers, so the county sheriff decreed that all local hangouts had to close by midnight. That Saturday, though, the Millennium stayed open past the curfew. According to court records, Gibson, accompanied by other officers, arrived and issued a citation. Dinky was on the dance floor at the time. "You done served your paper," Richard Lee told Gibson. "Now get your ass out of here." Gibson asked him to repeat himself. "What if I don't?" bellowed Richard Lee, coming around the bar. "You heard what I said. Get out of here before I throw you out." Gibson told him to try it. Richard Lee got up in his face. Gibson handcuffed him for disorderly conduct and led him into the back of a patrol car. Richard Lee, according to witnesses, started sobbing. He was later let off with a warning. Dinky, Gibson claims, was furious. Several of the officers present that night testified that Dinky spoke of how, if he ever became mayor, he would make sure Gibson was fired. Mayor Estes, after receiving questions posed by Vanity Fair, stated, "I'm not interested in being part of your investigation. I guess you're going to have to go to somebody else for your information." The following year, shortly after Ronnie's conviction, Dinky became Rosedale's mayor. And things seemed to quiet down until Gibson started investigating Mayor Estes on a complaint about underage drinking at the Millennium. During the inquiry, a police informant videotaped a shooting outside the club. Within days, Gibson was fired. Next photo, local lockup, a county facility named after Billy Joe Estes, the region's one-time chief investigator. The next 18 months were a struggle. Gibson applied for law enforcement jobs elsewhere, but he claimed he was told the city of Rosedale had given him a bad reference. His wife had just given birth to twins, and he was scraping by financially. He began crying at night, so he'd stay up and read the Bible. That was all that was there, you know. Around that time, the Cleveland News Leader, a local weekly, began working on a story on the county's powerful chief investigator, Billy Joe Estes. While reporting the piece, journalist for the paper contacted Estes by phone to ask him about inconsistencies in the Patrice Horsley case and other homicides that had happened on his watch. He yelled back and slammed down the receiver. And then, a short time later, Billy Joe Estes dropped dead. No one I spoke to in Rosedale was quite sure if he had had an aneurysm, stroke, or heart attack. His obituary lists no cause of death, but the consensus was that he died not long after being confronted by the reporters. The news leader is now defunct, yet I managed to track down its former editor, David Johnson. He is foggy on the timeline surrounding Billy Joe Estes' death, but he remembers other aspects of the story, which was never published, with precision. He tells me that the county sheriff, in response to the paper's request, had let his team see the Horsley investigative file. It contained very little documentation related to the crime. Part of the reason, Johnson had been informed, was that after the murder, Billy Joe had supposedly kept much of the evidence from the case in the trunk of his car, throughout the sweltering summer, effectively tainting it and killing off any usable DNA. The current chief investigator in the sheriff's department acknowledges that the evidence in the Horsley case was spoiled, telling me they intentionally tampered with it and destroyed it. The ex-DA, Lawrence Mellon, also remembers reading about blood-related evidence from one of the cases back then being rendered inadmissible after it had been stored in the trunk of a squad car during the summertime. That's just what happens in a small town, he offers. After Billy Joe's death, Anthony Gibson sued Dinky Estes and the town of Rosedale for malicious interference with employment. Gibson won the case and was awarded $60,000 in damages. But as the trial unfolded, Ronnie Estes' presence loomed over the proceedings. In fact, testimony was entered that described Gibson's investigations into Ronnie's possible role in three unsolved murders. In court, one of those who spoke on behalf of Gibson was an African-American investigator from the DA's office named David James. He described some of the hurdles that Gibson faced in pursuing justice in Rosedale. James testified, for instance, that in order to make sure that the Estes child abuse case wouldn't slip through the cracks of the court system, James himself had decided to go above the DA's head, directly to the state's attorney general. The judge asked James why. The case would not have gone anywhere, James replied, citing the deep personal connection between Ronnie's brother Billy Joe and DA Lawrence Mellon. The case would have been thrown in the trash. Unlike many of the others I've approached, James, now a private detective, agrees to meet me in a deserted parking lot. He is waiting for me in a black pickup truck and suggests I sit in the passenger seat and do the interview there. It turns out that he is very familiar with the Horsley matter. At the time of the murder, he'd been an undercover narcotics agent with the Central Delta Drug Task Force, and the sheriff asked him to look into the case. A week after the crime, James found it odd, he says, that Ronnie had a lot of scratches on him, and he'd been hurt, apparently during a struggle. His comment was that he had fallen in the bathtub. Following the murder, James recalls, he was approached by D.A. Mellon about going to work in his office. At that point, he told Mellon what he'd learned about the Horsley case. With him and Billy Joe being best of friends, James recounts, Lawrence gave me this little story about how he and Billy Joe are connected. One summer day, James tells me, Estes had taken Mellon out onto the Mississippi River in his John boat. They were logging for catfish, he says. You dive under the water, you see a catfish in a stump, and you pull it out with your hands before throwing the catch up into the boat. When the time had come to head to shore, and with Mellon still in the water, Estes, according to James, leaned down and said he'd decided not to take Mellon back with him, not until they'd made a deal. They were so far out, James recounts, and if Mellon didn't do exactly what Estes wanted him to do, then he wasn't going to get back in that boat. So Mellon made a promise to Billy Joe, and in effect Billy Joe's mama, that as long as she lived, he would keep Ronnie Estes out of prison. That's exactly what Lawrence Mellon said. He would make sure that Ronnie would never go to prison. Indeed, James testified in court that Mellon and Billy Joe Estes made just such an agreement. If true, the tale might answer a lot of questions. Once David James's story begins to sink in, I realize he's surely going to ask me not to use his quotes or his name, but he affirms that everything he said is meant for publication. People's lives are at stake, he says calmly. I took an oath of office. My oath stated that I was to protect the lives of the citizens. That's what I live by. My parents taught me to always stand up for what's right. Some people in life are afraid to stand up for themselves. Sometimes you may have to be the one to stand up for them. But what does Lawrence Mellon have to say in response? Today, Mellon is retired, having left his DA post in 2009 after 26 years. Reached by phone, Mellon at one point makes an enigmatic pronouncement. "I'm glad to meet someone over the phone who works for Vanity Fair," he says, describing it as a rough place to be. I ask him what he means. He explains that he's speaking about the immoral, vanity-plagued town in the Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan's 1678 novel. Mellon opens up at first and tells me he still misses Billy Joe, but says he doesn't know his brother, despite the fact that court records show he was present at Ronnie's sexual battery trial. "Did Billy Joe," I inquire, "ever speak about the challenges he faced regarding his brother's criminal activity?" "No," Mellon answers. "He wouldn't have had reason to that I know of." Mellon does confirm that Billy Joe, as the chief investigator in the sheriff's department, worked closely with him to provide information on which we made decisions regarding indictments and prosecutions. I ask if it is possible that Billy Joe might have withheld information in cases involving his brother. "If you're trying to say that Billy Joe covered something for him, I have no comment. I don't know the answer to that." "Do you think Billy Joe could have protected his brother?" I don't know. It'd be difficult," says Mellon. And then, "Now that I'm thinking of Billy Joe Estes, he would not have let his brother off. That's why I respected him." When I bring up David James's court testimony about a secret arrangement between Mellon and Billy Joe, he refutes James's account. Raising his voice, he says that he'd fired James from his position as chief criminal investigator for the DA's office, after which James filed a suit against Mellon and the state of Mississippi for unlawful termination. Mellon was granted qualified immunity, and the case never went to trial. "He sued me for $3 million. Went to federal court, and they threw it out. I'd be very careful if I were you." I ask him what he means by being careful. No comment. "Did you ever make any kind of deal with Billy Joe Estes to protect Ronnie?" "No." "Why would someone make such an accusation under oath in a court of law?" "Ask him," he suggests. I have no further comment. When I follow up with James, he says that Mellon did, in fact, fire him, but only after James had informed him that he planned on running for sheriff. Given all of this freighted history, James nonetheless stands by what he said in court about the alleged pact. "I'm not worried. My conscience is clear, because I'm telling the truth." Looking for answers, I call the current DA, Brenda F. Mitchell, who previously served under Mellon. Mitchell refuses to provide any comment, suggesting I try the sheriff's department instead. "Is there anything her office can do to help?" "You have a good day," she says, hanging up. The sheriff's department doesn't engage with me either. That is, until a local source of mine mentions that he once coached youth soccer with the current sheriff, Kelvin Williams Sr. After a phone call is placed, Williams agrees to let me come look at any background investigative material they have on the Patrice Horsley case. My meeting lasts the entire afternoon. Also present are the sheriff's two chief deputies and the county's chief investigator. In front of them sits Horsley's folder, which, to my relief, appears not to have been swallowed up by that long-ago tornado. My team's been pretty addicted to this file since you brought it to our attention, Sheriff Williams admits. The Horsley dossier is thin, exponentially thinner, they tell me, than a normal investigative report should be. It's a whole lot of puzzles just within that one file, the sheriff explains. It was poorly investigated, adds the current chief investigator, Michael Williams, no relation to Kelvin. It's not protocol. The file contains no police interrogation of Ronnie Estes, nor interviews with friends or relatives of the deceased. The dossier has a single interview, an audio recording, with a young Rosedale resident named Ricky Graham, who'd said he was with Horsley on the day she died. We listen to the tape and hear the voices of Graham and the interviewer, Billy Joe Estes. That's not how somebody sounds when they're a murder suspect, Chief Deputy Michael Lamb asserts. He's way too calm. In Graham's account, he states that he'd seen Horsley smoke at least 6 joints the day she died. The toxicology report showed no marijuana in her bloodstream. Instead, she had been high on crack. Billy Joe Estes asked Graham whether Ronnie had been with Horsley. No, he hadn't. Investigator Estes goes through a list of several other suspects in the case. No, they weren't either. Could this lone interview have been conducted to exonerate whoever may have been with Horsley that night? Graham, contacted today by the authorities, contradicts the taped interview, saying that Ronnie Estes was, in fact, with Horsley the night she died. When asked to listen to the interview from the Horsley file, he states that part of the recording may have been from an interview in an unrelated case. There are other documents in the binder. A semen test is referenced, conducted 9 months after the homicide, but the results aren't in the file. Neither is a sexual assault kit, which was supposed to have been sent to a lab for analysis. The file, however, does contain gruesome photos of the crime scene, and Chief Investigator Williams points out bite marks on one of Horsley's breasts. Also included is a full autopsy report, but the coroner makes no mention of bites or injuries to the breast. The report continues, the external genitalia is essentially unremarkable, with no cuts or lacerations identified. This runs counter to what Gibson and others say was a central element of the case, that Horsley had been sexually assaulted with part of a pecan tree. The sheriff's squad is at a loss as to why the coroner's report would contradict eyewitness accounts, as well as the photographic evidence. The case's forensic pathologist, Stephen T. Hain, contacted through his lawyer, did not respond to request for comment. What actually happened to Patrice Horsley? One former member of the sheriff's department who worked during the period of her murder is adamant that the killer had stuffed a stick up in her. That's what it was. David James, who was at the murder scene the morning her body was found, also tells me that she'd been raped with a tree branch. Lamb, the current chief deputy sheriff, points out that his team has also gathered testimony that the body of another slain woman, Ethel Webster, was found nearby. She was beaten to death with a stick and was sodomized with the same stick she was beaten with, he says, echoing what Gibson had told me. The sheriff's team cannot locate Webster's file, but after our meeting, they reopen the Patrice Horsley case, stating that they plan on interviewing Ronnie Estes in jail. And yet, several months later, I learned that those plans have changed. Estes will no longer be questioned. Is it that witnesses have suggested others might have been present when Horsley died? Or that the accounts of those interrogated today don't mesh with the facts in the original investigative file prepared by Billy Joe Estes? Or that Horsley and Webster, both African American, did not have consistent advocates over the years clamoring for justice on their behalf? No, I am told by a member of the sheriff's office, there is simply not enough evidence against Estes to merit an interview. The Magnolia Curtain has descended once again. Patrice Horsley's killer still hasn't been found, and Ronnie Estes is due to be released on October 2nd. Anthony Gibson tells me he is planning on moving to another state. His job as Beulah's chief of police was eliminated when the town ran out of funds to pay his salary. Still, he hopes that shedding light on these unsolved murders will make lives along Highway 1 a little safer. Something needs to be done about all the injustice in the Mississippi Delta, he says. People die, and no investigations go on. People just forget about it. They just move on. We can structure society better than that. It has to change. People just need to start somewhere.
Thank you.
Now we move on to the November 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Black Panther star Michael B. Jordan on the cover. From Kira Pollack comes this from the editors behind the issue. In the photos, Michael B. Jordan in a 1972 Chevrolet El Camino outside a school in East Hampton, New York, with Vanity Fair executive fashion director Samira Nasser on East Hampton's Louse Point Beach, at the Louse Point Beach. It's fitting for a star of Michael B. Jordan's wattage that even a photo shoot has a cinematic arc. For the images that accompany our profile of Jordan, the Vanity Fair team and photographer Cass Bird headed out to the eastern tip of Long Island, to a part of the Hamptons known as the Springs, where Jackson Pollock, Nora Ephron, and other creative lions have lived and worked. That list also includes Cass, who retreats to the Springs with her own family, so she knew exactly what spots to hit for some magical late summer light. First stop was a local public school, which was gearing up for the fall semester. Michael held court on the court with some neighborhood kids who got him to pose for selfies. And Cass offered up some magic of her own when she coaxed Michael into the water, wearing his Saint Laurent tuxedo, just as the sun was dipping below Gardiner's Bay. The result was infectious. Executive fashion director Samira Nasser and editor Radhika Jones were knee-deep before long. One of the pictures from that dip became our cover, that of a star emerging.
Thank you.
from the creator of Mad Men, The Romanoffs. The highly anticipated contemporary series, The Romanoffs, is set to premiere on Amazon Prime Video Friday, October 12th, with new episodes released weekly on Fridays. The Romanoffs is created, written, and directed by 9-time Emmy Award winner Matthew Weiner, Mad Men, and reunites 14 of Mad Men's creative team. Featuring 8 unique stories about people who believe themselves to be descendants of the Russian royal family, each episode takes place in a new location with a new star-studded cast. Set in 7 countries around the globe, The Romanoffs was shot on location on 3 continents. Episodes 1, The Violet Hour, October 12th, set in Paris, an ancestral home holds the key to a family's future. Starring Aaron Eckhart, Marta Keller, Ines Milab, and Louise Bourgoin. Location, Paris. 2, The Royal We, October 12th. With their marriage in a rut, a couple finds their own temptations. Starring Corey Stoll, Carrie Bichet, Janet Montgomery, and Noah Weil. Location, Ohio. 3, House of Special Purpose, October 19th. A movie star and a director go head-to-head in a battle over what is real. Starring Christina Hendricks, Isabelle Huppert, Jack Houston, Mike Doyle, and Paul Reiser. Location, Austria. Expectation, October 26th. Over a single day in New York City, a woman is confronted with every lie she ever told. Starring Amanda Peet, John Slattery, Emily Rudd, John Tenney, Mary Kay Place, and Michael O'Neill. Location, New York City. Bright and High Circle, November 2nd. A trusted friend under suspicion tests the loyalties of a tightly knit family. Starring Diane Lane, Ron Livingston, Andrew Rennells, Cara Buono, and Nicole Ari Parker. Location, Los Angeles. Panorama, November 9th. In Mexico City, an idealistic reporter falls in love with his mysterious subject. Starring Juan Pablo Castañeda, Radha Mitchell, and Griffin Dunn. Location, Mexico City. End of the Line, November 16th. On a trip abroad to pursue their legacy, a couple faces destruction. Starring Catherine Hahn, J.R. Ferguson, Anna Mahindru, and Clea Duval. Location, Russia. The One That Holds Everything, November 23rd. In a story that circles the globe, a man tries to escape a family curse. Starring Hugh Skinner, Adele Anderson, Ira Hilmar, Ben Miles, and J.J. Field. Location, London and Hong Kong. Watch Fridays, starting October 12th, Prime Video. Thank you. Now here's the editor's letter for November 2018 from Radhika Jones, editor. In the photos, Michael B. Jordan and Radhika Jones at Louse Point Beach in East Hampton, New York. Since the last time this magazine published its annual new establishment list, the establishment has taken a number of well-deserved knocks. Down the titans fell, a bunch of them anyway, from Hollywood to Palo Alto to Washington, and so the new establishment of 2018 is newer than ever. Disruption has been the irritating buzzword of our era since the tech boom began, but it's arguably in the past 12 months that this ethos started to democratize itself and to become a true cultural force, one that delivered returns. Once upon a time, the disruptors tended to be the people in charge. Now they can also be the women who fight harassment, or underserved audiences who turn out to see Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, or political candidates who answer to their constituents over their party and their party's donors. This letter will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.